Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Tuesday, January 31st, Alan and Joe were joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and the former Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
President Biden announced that he will end COVID national emergencies in May. The White House announced its intent in response to GOP efforts to end the declarations immediately. President Biden told Congress on Monday that he will end the national emergencies to combat the coronavirus outbreak on May 11th, a move that will restructure the federal government's response to the pandemic nearly 3 years after the virus first arrived in the U.S. The declaration came as Biden announced his opposition to House Republicans' efforts to end the emergency declarations immediately, a move the White House argued would cause chaos and disrupt efforts at an orderly winding down of the emergency status. The expiration of the orders marks a new phase of the pandemic response as U.S. officials prepare to remove some of the flexibilities that were instituted during the earliest and most dire days of the pandemic. Since then, most Americans have been fully vaccinated against the virus, and life has largely returned to normal. Still, an average of more than 500 Americans are dying every day from COVID-19.
Yeah, I kept thinking about, you don't want to be one of those 500, right? I mean, you'd be dead, and you wouldn't love it. So, therefore, we have to be very cautious about the way we're doing this. And I don't know why there are some people who seem to be opposed to moving ahead aggressively.
Well, I think that the White House's decision or their proposal to do this in May isn't a commentary on where COVID rates are in the nation. It's about the authorities and the resources that are available to the federal government during this time period. So, I'm not an expert on what those specific authorities are, but I know they've allowed some extra emphasis on quick research, and they've allowed quicker funding of things like the vaccines that are still available to all of us for free, many times through our county governments. And it might affect the availability of some of the free testing, the home tests that the Biden administration was sending out. So it's, whether or not COVID continues to exist, which I think it's pretty clear we're going to be living with COVID for the foreseeable future, it's about how the federal government structures its response. And so they're going to be stepping back from this emergency footing they've been on.
Isn't this, Mike, what they have been talking about of moving it from a pandemic to an endemic?
It is, and this is part of that transition. I guess it's recognition of that. And we're into, when they say back to normal, I think it's a new normal. When I fly in a plane and go in big public places, I still wear a mask. People's behavior has been altered. But this is also a political story. Members, newly emboldened Republicans who lead the House of Representatives, have called for an immediate end of all emergency status. The White House says they shouldn't do that. It would have ramifications where it would leave states and local communities and agencies up in the air about who's going to fund continued treatments and testing, et cetera, like that. And they need to have some kind of transition, which I think makes sense. The question is, what needs to happen now to protect us going forward after we're beyond an emergency status on this? And will there be research and funding on the federal level to provide more research for tracking variants, developing more vaccines that would treat this? We heard just last week, and it was not without some controversy, that they're going to try to phase a annual COVID vaccine, just like the annual flu vaccine, perhaps even bundle them.
Right.
Whether that's the right strategy right now, some scientists weren't sure. But this is all going to take a commitment from our our health, agencies, and unless they're funded, I mean, that's what happened during COVID. People became angry at the restrictions. Politicians responded by defunding and wanting to defund various agencies and get people fired. And there's still a lot of anger and a lot of resentment. And will there not be the necessary public resources we need to have the ongoing battle after it's officially no longer an emergency? That's the real question.
Malia?
I don't think the government is going to stop funding these efforts. And if God forbid, there's some new variant that causes an emergency situation again, the federal government can decide to go back onto an emergency footing. But I wonder how
that would go over.
I think Mike's right that this is more of a political story. At this point, the Centers for Disease Control is going to continue looking into this. I think research into long COVID, for example, there's a lot that's not understood about that. But I think the way we, the average citizen, will see this is perhaps less availability, less widespread availability of free tests, and just how the vaccines will roll out in the future, that's a question.
It is wild how in a relatively, you think of a couple of years and you think it's not that long of a time and how far we have come in terms of our thinking about the disease in those short few years. You know, I looked up the vaccine tracker for New York State. In New York State, 15% of adults are up to date on their vaccine. So that's 85% of New Yorkers are not up to date on their vaccine. And you take that, that's for adults. For kids, I'm sure it's way less. I think about 85%, you're right, it is a political story, Mike, but 85%, that cuts across both political parties.
You mean, like, haven't had every booster available?
Yeah.
Is that what
yeah.
that means?
Like, that cuts across every race, gender, socioeconomic, geography. That's 85% of people are not up to their, up to.
I think some people got booster fatigue.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's changed or not, but I believe it was considered to be vaccinated was, depending on what shot you got, one or two. Mm. And then after that, the boosters were sort of an add-on bonus that they weren't counting, that they would still call you vaccinated at that point. But to your very good point, 15% fully vaccinated and having, so that would be
three boosters.
Yeah, yeah. Two initial shots.
Four.
Yeah, two initial shots and the booster. So
lost track.
Yeah,
there's also someone who always sends me the story to put on Empire Report, which I do from time to time, which is the CDC recommends mask wearing in these 5 counties in New York or 10 counties in New York, and you kind of wonder, like, do people listen to that? You know, why is the CDC recommending that if no one's following it? You know, it's just we're in a very unique time. And of course, you look at the stats and 500 people a day are dying from this, and nobody wants to get it.
Does anyone in this room right now know somebody who has it?
Oh, I think I know somebody who had it in the last week or two.
Yeah, yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but they were also vaccinated and they went through they isolate a little bit and they got over it. And that's a story we hear a lot, thank goodness, because of vaccinations. And we're able to say that now. And I know people have had the flu, or I know people have had other illnesses. Somebody had a cold. I mean, we are now at that level. But the sad reality is that we don't have, as a society, many of us have lost faith in our government and our public health agencies. There was a story in the Times Union last week about how Schoharie County, which is just west of Albany County, pushed out their health commissioner, the head of the health department there, because she had been too aggressive about restrictions during the COVID crisis. And the state health department ordered
her. She didn't want people getting sick?
That's right.
Yeah.
And there was an objection to it, so they canned her. The state health department said they got to hire her back, but now there's fighting over that and everything. Yeah, I mean, it shows how this has become a ideological and political kind of a dispute, which is tragically sad.
Yeah, what's tragically sad too is everyone I know in China has a relative who's died like in the past 2 months, and they've had their COVID surge. I mean, it's that's tragedy on tragedy there, that they had much stronger restrictions than we did. People were locked down for years, and the government didn't use that time to actually prepare for the eventual tsunami of COVID.
And do you think we did here in this country?
I think we did a better job than China.
But
apparently we
which
did.
Which is not a great barometer for success in this,
But looking to the future, I mean, are we ready? If as Mike was talking about, if the funding is now frozen and we're not looking forward to the future, are we setting ourselves up for future variants that perhaps could come from China, number one?
I don't know if the funding is frozen. I think the rapidity with which it can be dispersed is affected. I think we set up a lot of great systems during this time. I mean, all the different vaccine points that are around everywhere that can be easily sort of reinstated. We do have, I know the 15% that are fully vaccinated and fully boosted is low, but if you look at just those fully vaccinated, it's a large number of people. It's still by far the majority of New Yorkers who did get the vaccine. So and it's a good working vaccine. That's the problem they had in China. They refused to use a foreign-made vaccine, and their domestically produced vaccines were much less effective than the ones we have here. So,
do you think it's worse in China because they were more stringent on the lockdowns, and we were less stringent on the lockdowns, and that's why it's worse there?
No, I think it has to do with the effectiveness of their vaccines. Actually,
I believe. What I've read, you know, agrees with what you just said, Malia, but JP, you make a good point. People here look at China having a zero tolerance policy where everybody was in masks, everybody was restricted, everybody was isolated. People couldn't even go home from the cities where they worked to visit their parents and their families during the Lunar New Year. Everything was locked down. And now all these people are dying. See, it didn't really help. People get a piece of the story, and then it will affirm their already presupposition that lockdowns don't help. See, I guess Ron DeSantis was doing the right thing when he was banning mask requirements and vaccine requirements from private employers and stuff like that. I mean, that's the trouble. It's become murky. And in order for Congress... I'm sorry, in order for the government to do all the things, the CDC to do what they need to do and the research to happen, there will be funding fights in Congress. And that's pretty obvious that this House of Representatives isn't going to be that interested.
They're not going to make it a priority. Yeah, that's true.
And Mike, you bring up a good point on the politicization of this. Is it would be great, I think, if we had a nonpartisan congressional commission made up of both Democrats and Republicans and look at what happened over the last 3 years and what worked well in Florida and what didn't work well in Florida and what worked well in New York and California and what didn't work well in those places. Because I imagine that there are some things that New York and California did were not as good as Florida and some things that Florida did that were not as good as New York and California.
Yeah,
so
we
that
could
going
learn a lot.
Forward, we can come up with a nonpartisan, okay, we understand that the Republicans are going to think DeSantis did better and the Democrats are going to think Newsom and Cuomo did better, but have a nonpartisan view of when this happens again, which it probably will, this is the best path forward to save the most lives and to keep people living their lives as much as possible while being safe.
Let's go to some letters on this, actually. My doctor said not to worry since I test positive for antibodies. Never had symptoms either. I'm not current. That according to Garrett. Who is getting the boosters? Is age a factor? Is education a factor? That's from
That's
Jackie.
Interesting. I mean, we have offered a number of booster clinics at Bard, and everyone signs up for them. They get fully subscribed really quickly, and it's everyone from students to professors emeritus, so the full range of ages.
I walked into my pharmacy about a week ago, and I said, "Oh, are you still busy giving the boosters?" I go, "No,
yeah,
no, not anymore." I applaud Biden, writes Ellen. If we do not recalibrate and carefully move towards different COVID measures, we could very well not make use of all the terribly hard-won experience careful and intelligent COVID measures have found. A very good point. Of course, we need to proceed with careful action. That from Ellen. Let's see. According to the New York Times today, writes Kay, an average of more than 500 people in the U.S. are still dying from COVID, about twice the number of deaths per day during a bad flu season. To my limited scope of thinking, if 500 people each day perished in a U.S. air traffic calamity, the FAA would likely shut down all domestic commercial air travel until the trend such tragedies could be minimized.
Yeah, one point about that, if the 506 new deaths that today's New York Times lists is down 10% from what it was in the last 2 weeks. So, I mean, it's trending downward right now, 45,000 new cases, but it's trending downward by 23%. So, I mean, those are interesting and useful in how we navigate through this.
But also yet, to JP.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
To JP's point, I mean, so, yes, the federal government manages air traffic, but as we learned a lot about local government, I think, during the pandemic. And different states, different localities are the ones that have set the policies that most regulate people's lives during the pandemic.
According to the Johns Hopkins University COVID website, there were 14,796 U.S. deaths due to COVID in the past 28 days. The other number we were giving was for just New York. If we had a president as intelligent and reasonable as Biden, writes Ellen, when the horror of COVID struck, I say many more Americans would still be alive today. Idiotic to follow the exception, not the rule. Your ongoing discussions, writes Cheryl, regarding the vaccine rates does not take into consideration the fact that there are those of us who cannot get the vaccine. It has nothing to do with political views or disbeliefs. It has to do with medical problems. Perhaps it would be wise to encourage people who are sick to wear a mask when out in public. That is responsible. That is respectful societal behavior. And that is from Cheryl, and certainly a good point. Well, this is a little bon mot. Just in, U.S. Representative George Santos, who has admitted to fabricating much of his resume, told fellow Republican lawmakers today he would not serve on committees for now. He just said he recused himself for a while, and then he'll come back. Representative Don Bacon told reporters after attending a closed-door meeting of House Republicans. The story is breaking as of about 12 minutes ago, so details are still coming in as reporters are tracking down exactly what that means.
The timing of this, he did, I believe, the reports were that he met with Kevin McCarthy individually yesterday, I believe, for the first time, and that may have been, as Alan suggested, the result of the meeting saying, you need to step down from the committees if you want us to play ball with your shenanigans.
I try not, whenever I'm hosting the show, I try not to bring the level of discourse to the way I ask these questions at home. But what was McCarthy thinking just like to put him on the committees a week and a half ago? I mean, what changed? What changed? That's what I don't understand. What changed at that point from McCarthy's view? The issues are the issues. They didn't go away. They weren't going to go away. They were
well documented.
They were well documented, and they were adding and adding and adding. But it's not like any of this was secret information that McCarthy didn't know when he added them to the committees a week and a half ago.
Well, but McCarthy needs the troops, and he needs individuals, and he, you know, he's got that, and that's been widely reported. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, public opinion does sway the way politicians do react.
Yeah. Meaning that the reaction to him being named
to committees.
McCarthy naming him to committees.
Oh, that and yes, and essentially recognizing him and giving him status equal of other members. As you know, many Republicans, in fact, the majority of Republican members of the House from New York State have called for Santos to step down. So if there was ever a vote that got to the floor of whether he should be ejected from the House of Representatives, and McCarthy would probably block that. But if that were to happen,
he'd
lose. And Santos would be gone. A special election would be held. And I'm sure a Democrat would probably be elected, probably Tom Suozzi.
And you have a very close House. So
that'll make a difference.
Yeah.
There's a word we use in the military. It's called voluntold. So I think that Santos, yes, may like have been voluntold. Because nobody for a second believes that he has suddenly decided that he needs to appear to have some kind of integrity, right? The guy doesn't know what that means. So I'm sure it wouldn't have occurred to him to do this on his own.
Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, January 31st. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, February 2nd, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Ellerbe, Albany Law School professor, director of the Justice Center, and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, and Wall Street investment banker, Mark Whitman.
We've talked a lot about the debt ceiling and the debt limit, but I would like to talk about the relationship between the new House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and the President of the United States. They met yesterday to talk about how to raise the federal debt ceiling, and McCarthy came out of the meeting and said he saw potential common ground after meeting privately with Biden for more than an hour Wednesday to kick off talks aimed at averting a potentially catastrophic default on the national debt. Speaking to reporters outside the White House after the meeting, McCarthy said he and the president agreed to address the debt limit in a responsible way and that they are not discussing cutting Social Security or Medicare as some Republican lawmakers have pushed. Alan, what do you make of that?
Well, if you know, you gotta really believe that the American people are wise to this sort of cat and mouse game that goes on every time. We are in a place where we really do have to be responsible with the people's money and with the people's ideas. And I think that this is a very good moment for us to look at that.
Mark.
I have a few thoughts. If you look at this dance between the Republicans and the Democrats, it reminds me a lot of when you see in a municipality a very essential union negotiating with government, say the police or even the sanitation workers, threatening to strike. The people at the bargaining table are sort of hostage to groups that aren't at the table, and there's a certain amount of performance, heat, and light that has to emanate from the negotiating table before either side is satisfied that their representative went to the mat on their behalf. And certainly there is some of that going on here. A couple of other observations. It's interesting, Mitch McConnell is right when he says that whatever gets worked out has to be palatable to the House and to the president, and it should then work in the Senate. But he said an interesting phrase when he said, well, we are behind Kevin McCarthy, which I think sums up a lot of Mitch McConnell's political career, sort of standing behind others at the forefront of controversies. I think Mitch has proven himself perfectly happy to stand behind somebody else and blame them for a kerfuffle like this. The other third observation I have is, if you recall back during the Obama administration, this happened twice, and in at least one case, Joe Biden himself was actually the point negotiator for the debt ceiling limit. It's interesting to take some comfort from the fact that he's seen this dance before. I'm also curious to see if Biden asks his vice president to take a similar role this time around. That might be instructive.
So do you think people take this thing seriously, this negotiation that we have come to see so many times?
Well, when you ask
people
who are the people you're asking about?
You.
I mean, the people in the country who are looking and reading the newspapers.
I think, and I mentioned this before, I think this is a lot like when your small child starts dancing upon a ledge. Mm-hmm. And if they fall and hit their head, it could be catastrophic. The odds that they're going to do that are pretty small, but you do nonetheless ask them to come down.
You better.
And inevitably they say, well, look, I can do this on 1 foot before they come down. Yeah. And all the time as a parent, you're thinking, well, the last 1,000 times they did this safely, but there is the chance they gash their head open. I think that's how most of America looks upon this dance.
Wow. I would just think that putting a kid out on a ledge is like a no.
No, they get there themselves.
I understand. I just like, you know, that's bad. But okay, Sarah.
Oh, I'm still trying to learn about all this, even though I was an economics major in college. So I'm learning, you know, this goes back to Alexander Hamilton, which immediately I just start singing lyrics in my head,
yeah,
and
sure.
then get distracted. So there's this.
I'll sing along with you.
Oh, thank you. Because you should sing over me, because otherwise people start tuning out. But modern monetary theory, does anybody know about that? But that this whole idea that, so the U.S. citizens apparently are the people who have the biggest stake in this matter, and the debt in question is some of the most like secure debt on the planet and is held in everybody's retirement portfolios. So more people should really care about, I should care about this more than I do. But I think to Mark's point, it's so important. It's such a bedrock of our budgeting process that it's hard to get too excited about it unless you're in Washington, D.C. and can use it for leverage.
So modern monetary theory basically meaning print as much money as you need.
No. What is Mark?
Well, yes, but just to clear things up, modern monetary theory is the theory that deficits don't matter. And I'd like to quote one of the experts that I follow when he talked about refuting that. He started by saying, it's so stupid, I can't believe I have to refute it. Deficits do matter. If you want to find out why, just look to what happened in the United Kingdom this summer. If you don't have a country that looks to the markets like it's on sound financial footings, the markets will punish you and make life very difficult for you. The issue here with the deficit is, I'm sorry, with the deficit ceiling, is it has nothing to do with the budgetary process. It's basically as if your credit card has come due and you and your partner now are agreeing to stroke the check to pay off the credit card. You've already spent the money. You just somehow have to agree to take the money out of your joint account. That's the exercise that we're watching happen. And the Republicans have decided, they started back in Newt Gingrich's time, they've decided that when there's a Democratic president in place, they're going to use this threat, this sort of murder-suicide threat, to extract these vague promises on spending reductions. And if you recall, during Trump, they raised this limit 3 times without any kerfuffle around extracting spending promises.
Linda.
I kind of want to start by quoting Adam Schiff from last week, because I like simple English, and debt, deficit, debit, these are not my areas. This is. Adam said last week, he said, let's not overcomplicate this. Republicans passed a $2 trillion tax cut for billionaires and corporations, and now they're refusing to pay for it. It's just that simple. And it really is just that simple. The fact is, you know, the debt is what we've accumulated over the years, over the country. The deficit is what we spend, and what we take in is more of a short-term thing. And the Republicans are absolutely counting on people conflating the two and getting a little confused. I mean, if America defaults on its debt, the whole world fails. But we didn't, under Trump, that didn't happen because, as you said, they made an enormous tax cut there for the wealthy. And you could, right this minute, You could cure 90% of what Kevin McCarthy is whining about if you just rolled back that tax cut.
And, Mark?
Well, Linda, I think you're apt to – I think that's a very insightful observation. And if you read the press, even in the last couple days, it does seem like the Republicans have succeeded in making this a discussion about spending cuts as opposed to about basically the net of what we tax and then what we spend. And so you're right. I think the Republicans, in a way, already have the upper hand in this negotiation, never mind the fact that, as you say, this doesn't need to be a negotiation at this point over the spending cap, and the Democrats have, I'm sorry, the Republicans have gotten the upper hand just by making the threats that they've made here.
So this is like a big government, small government thing, essentially. Over and over and over and over and over again.
And we know that the Republicans, when they talk about cuts and spending cuts, we know what they're talking about. They are talking about Social Security,
right,
and Medicare, and especially Medicaid, because, by golly, that helps poor people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
William writes to us and says, why does the panel ignore what's happening at our southern border, not bringing this issue up? Since 2020, the cartels have astronomically increased their profits in trafficking humans and drugs, making tens of billions in the process. Fentanyl seeps through our porous border, killing over 100,000 Americans each year. The way to stop the cartels is for the U.S. to designate them as terrorists. The cartels have bought off Mexico. Don't you think they're already working on doing the same with the U.S.? Once they succeed, there's no turning back. Have they bought off Joe Biden? What else could explain his refusal to secure our border?
Yeah, what else?
They might have bought off
May
the department.
May I take this one, please?
Yes, please go for it.
First of all, I would like to remind the gentleman that there are more people from the United States moving to Mexico every year than there are Mexicans trying to get in the U.S. every year. It's good to keep that in mind, okay? Secondly, the cartels have not bought off the U.S. any more than the American mobsters have bought off the U.S. or the Republican Party has bought off the U.S. We have seen such bad border policy and such mixed border policy, and every time we have a president from a different party, we get even more mixed border policy. This is a big problem. This does need big solutions. And he is right to ask, why don't we discuss that every day? Well, that is because news that is news every day stops being news and becomes fact. And in journalism, like it or not, we report news, not fact. When something happens on the border, we report it. When news is made there, we report it. To say that there has been no reporting about the problems of the United States border is to bury one's head in the sand and say, I guess I just don't read English. Because there has been plenty of reporting, and there is every single day, all over the place. I think what you mean is, why hasn't the reporting satisfied what you want to hear?
That's right.
And why hasn't what been done satisfied what you want done?
That's
a separate question.
Yeah.
I'm done.
That was good.
That was very good.
Sarah.
I mean, and if you know the answer, feel free to, you know, pass it along to the White House.
Happy to have it.
Because this is an issue. This is a multi. He raises like at least six different issues in that question, and few of them actually have to do with this current administration and migration patterns. In the 2020 balloon, guess who was president between 2016 and 2020? Anybody?
Yeah.
Remember
that guy
the guy that said, you can't come in. We're going to destroy asylum. We're going to make sure that people from majority Muslim countries cannot enter the United States. We're going to shut down our airports, shut down our borders, stop issuing visas. I'm going to disembowel the Department of State. And I'm going to ramp up the green machine created under the Bush administration, which is the Customs and Border Patrol and Department of Homeland Security. And we're just going to give them a bunch more toys. And last but not least, build that wall.
which
and Mexico will pay for it.
Right. Right. None of that happened. That's not true. A lot of that happened, and what happened was that it created this crisis that we're seeing. I've worked with people seeking safety in the Matamoros refugee camps that Joe Biden cleared in his first 6 months, okay? What you're seeing is a ramp up of crime and cartels taking advantage of multiple failures in policy that were exacerbated to a degree that is historically unprecedented by the Trump administration. And that's not just pointing fingers. That's a fact. I'm in the law and fact business and less of the news business, but that's a fact.
This seems as good a time as any to tell folks that Sarah is in a documentary that is going to be, when does it air? It airs
Sunday night at 10 o'clock after the Grammys.
On
MSNBC.
MSNBC.
Well, they're dealing with the Grammys.
For me, it is.
Yeah, you can stream it later.
You can stream it.
It's called Gorilla Habeas, and it is from Trevor Noah's documentary division.
Yeah. Yeah,
and his production company.
Yeah, it's a Turning Point documentary series. It's a series of documentaries that have been airing on MSNBC, and this is one of them. They cover a wide range of topics, and this one is on immigration. And the reason behind the title, Gorilla Habeas, is because I was part of a legal team that worked, and I continued to work with Sarah Gilman, one of the partners in that legal team, on cases up till now, just in a much less dramatic fashion, where habeas corpus is a tool to be able to interrupt rapid deportations under the Trump administration and make sure that the federal government follows its own rules when applying the law to immigrants who, for all intents and purposes, have not broken any laws that would justify their deportation to a country or a place where they would certainly be killed. So pretty dramatic, pretty intense. It's just over 47 minutes running time. So if it's close to your bedtime, Alan, just, you know, drink your tea a little bit later.
No, not me. But it goes by six.
Stream it, find it later. But it's Gorilla Habeas.
It's a great idea.
It tells the story of two intrepid lawyers, Sarah Gilman being one of them.
Right.
And in their crusade against ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the epidemic of deportations tearing individuals from their families and communities. 10 o'clock Sunday night, MSNBC. We'll continue our conversation with letters. May I remind a previous letter writer that as much as I believe his presidency was a disaster, President G.W. Bush proposed a reasonable immigration policy that addressed many of our current immigration policies. And who killed this proposal? The Republican Congress. That's who. Is that accurate?
I believe they're referring to a group of Congress members that put together a package. I don't believe it came from the executive, if I'm remembering things correctly. But yes, it's true that the Republicans killed it. They always do.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, February 2nd. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this break. Thank you. Welcome to the final segment of this week's roundtable panel, The Week in Review. Please note, as you listen, any given topic's details or facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. On Friday, February 3rd, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, faculty at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastics, and former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck, and Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti.
U.S. employers have added 517,000 jobs last month. It is a surprisingly strong number, according to government officials who released these numbers today. Aaron, do what you do so well.
This is almost unbelievable. The U.S. economy added 517,000 jobs in January. That is, 116,000 more jobs than were added on average in 2022. So it's the labor market continues to be red hot. The unemployment rate fell from 3.5 to 3.4, which is, the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. The labor market is fine. Workers who want a job can get a job. Businesses are still increasing their job openings. That was a report that came out earlier this week. So that's the good news. I don't want to say bad news because it's not explicitly bad news, but the Federal Reserve met earlier this week and announced that they were raising interest rates from by a quarter of a percentage point to 4.75%. The Federal Reserve, whose primary objective is to maintain macroeconomic stability, but since 2021, their goal has been to keep the labor market strong, but also battle high inflation. And those goals are in conflict with one another, right? If you juice the economy with low borrowing costs, we add jobs, but we get more inflation. The Fed's trying to do the opposite now, and they are engaging in the most aggressive contractionary policy ever. So in spite of all of that, the labor market remains strong, historically low unemployment rates, historically high job growth. But there are some signs that what the Fed is doing is starting, by making borrowing costs more expensive, is starting to trickle through the rest of the economy. And it's trickling through the rest of the economy, slowing some sectors at a very gradual pace. And that's exactly what the Fed is trying to accomplish. So wage growth for the average worker in January fell from 4.8% to 4.4%. So that's, historically high wage growth, but it's been coming down for the past couple months, and that's what the Fed wanted to do. It wants to ease the economy back into a low inflationary environment without, creating mass layoffs and sending the economy into a recession. We're seeing slowing growth in housing construction. We're seeing rising mortgage rates, which is going to further decrease the demand for housing. Construction spending has fallen. Consumer spending has fallen just a little bit in December. So this is good news that we've seen inflation come down from its peak of 8.5% to 6.4%. And the labor market and the economy remains remarkably strong despite that. So the Fed's goal is to achieve a soft landing, reduce inflation without creating a recession. Now, what the Fed is doing by raising borrowing costs can take, 6 to 12 months before the effects are felt throughout the rest of the economy. So we're not out of the woods yet. There is still the potential that job growth slows, that unemployment starts going up as these interest rate increases, start to affect, more than just the housing market at this point. But, for the time being, I think this is, an opportunity to celebrate, fairly competent economic management of a very uncertain and tumultuous couple years.
And it seems like the obvious question is, so what will February look like? And will we see that same type of growth? Because typically we don't, no. Right?
Yeah. You don't want to make too much out of you don't want to make too strong a forecast based on 1 month's worth of data. I would be willing to wager that January was an anomaly, that come February and March and, you know, spring 2023, job growth will probably come down to more, you know, historically reasonable numbers, perhaps, you know, 200 to 250,000 jobs a year. Unemployment might tick up from, you know, 3.4 to 4%. But again, the labor market has been so hot and so strong that even if there are layoffs, it's not enough to trigger a massive recession. So most economists still think that come late 23, early 24, that the U.S. economy will enter probably what is likely to be a short and mild recession. But we're getting a lot of evidence that that seems to be increasingly unlikely as of right now.
Judith?
What's going on with the price of eggs? So,
sure.
I mean, I, you know, yes, this is great news. And but I also think that there's such sticker shock when you go grocery shopping. And there were reports this week on quarterly earnings for Exxon and Shell just making unbelievable record profits. And you always think of that when you're at the gas station. So, you know, I think for a lot of voters in particular, the price of eggs is probably going to drive their view of the state of the economy more than anything else.
So, no, I apologize for interrupting. I have a question. So, to Judith's questions about eggs. I was talking to a poultry farmer last Wednesday in Saratoga, and they were telling me that they have a big farm and they supply a lot of eggs, and that the reason for, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the reason for the increase is because of bird flu, and mm-hmm. it's killing the birds, and that is keeping the numbers down, and there is more demand for eggs than there are actual eggs. So my question is, this particular farmer has never had a bird that's had as much as the sniffles, and yet they're still charging the $6.99 for mm-hmm. a dozen eggs. So, and they say, well, they are regulated as to how much they sell their product for, much like milk. There's a device put into play. Well, that's what I don't understand. I mean, isn't the one thing we have going for ourselves is that if we live in a rural community, that we can get eggs because the chickens are all over the place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I get the outbreak of avian flu has reduced the supply of eggs, and that pushed up its price. That's a temporary shock. You know, most eggs come from these giant poultry farms. It's not your local country farmer that we were talking about. So, yeah, that it, you know, is primarily affecting the really big producers and distributors of eggs. But to what Judith was saying, and kind of what Joe was alluding to, is that there's a lot of economic opportunism that happens when there's inflation, because you can say, well, you know, the price of things are, you know, going up, and it's very easy to squeeze out a little bit more of a profit margin when consumers have kind of become accustomed to rising prices, even if that producer themselves is not experiencing an increase in costs. So you see this with, you know, the big oil and gas companies. The farm that I get my eggs from hasn't raised the price of eggs in, 6 years. So it's not particularly a widespread phenomenon, but you know, consumers buy eggs and they see the sticker shock and they think, oh my God, the world's coming to an end. Consumer confidence today is as low as it's been since the fairly catastrophic double dip recession in the early 1980s. That doesn't make sense. We have the strongest labor market, wages are growing. The only issue is that we have this temporary inflation due to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, interruptions in supply chains, and now an avian flu outbreak with eggs. Sure, consumers lose sight of the big picture. Most of them aren't economists, but it's a topsy-turvy world, and, you know, eggs will recover, and then in a couple months, it'll be something else that has people scratching their heads.
Does that answer your question, Judith, sort of?
Yeah, yeah. And factor in reduced cholesterol. There's an economic benefit there.
So let's switch to you. And when we talk about the price of, when we're talking about, you know, these companies, just the oil companies making gobs and gobs of money, we're told that prices of petroleum products is again on the rise. So what do we make of that, Judith? And how does that go into the narrative of getting people to curb their habits?
Well, you know, the price of oil is all over the map, but one thing that always happens consistently is record profits for companies like ExxonMobil and Shell and ConocoPhillips. And they, you know, they want to do more oil drilling. Are we backing into that story now, Joe? You want to talk about the Willow Project?
I would love to talk about the Willow Project. This is... let me get out of my egg letters. Hold on, Judith. I'll be right with you. We got a lot of letters on eggs. Mm-hmm. We'll allow those to hatch later. So as far as the Alaska Oil Project, this is the story about President Biden clearing the way for Alaska Oil Project. The administration issued an analysis that indicates a scaled-back version of the Willow Project could go forward. Opponents call the drilling plan a carbon bomb. I was actually going to call in the headlines this story carbon bomb, but then I knew I wouldn't know what I meant. So the Bureau of Land Management issued an environmental analysis that says the government prefers a scaled back version of the project, which is known as Willow. The assessment calls for curtailing the project to 3 drill sites from 5, as well as reducing the proposed length of both gravel and ice roads, pipelines, and the length of airstrips to support the drilling. So this is the Biden administration taking a crucial step towards approving $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil drilling project on the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. We have heard for years, Judith, about drilling in Alaska, and here we are. So what do we make of this?
Well, this is enormously disappointing from the Biden administration. I mean, I understand that the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, not exactly the most pro-environmental federal agency, has to process these applications when it comes in. But in what world, where we've had, you know, the last 8 years have been the hottest on record. In what world do you approve a new oil drilling project in a sensitive area in Alaska that's going to crank out 600 million barrels of oil over 30 years? When that oil is burned, it will make the climate crisis worse. It's not just the oil drilling and the burning of the oil. It's also 89 miles of pipeline, 400 miles of new ice roads. And we do have the Department of Interior on record saying that they have substantial concerns about the greenhouse gas emission and impacts, and also what a project like this does to wildlife in Alaska, especially for Alaska Native communities that are rely on subsistence fishing and hunting to survive. It's so offensive to hear that, well, rather than 5 drill sites, they're going to do 3 drill sites. And I kid you not, they're also going to add some tree planting as a mitigation measure. That may be how Washington works, where an oil giant like ConocoPhillips overstates what they want to do. Maybe they knew they would never get the 5 drill sites. So the Biden administration says, you can't do 5, you can do 3. That may be the world of Washington. It's not the world of science. We are in a climate crisis, and reducing a gargantuan project like this from 5 to 3 doesn't solve the problem. This is not the final decision. There's about a month before the final decision comes out. I hope the president gets briefed on this. I hope he changes course, because it's really hard to take his climate change agenda seriously. You know, he's doing some very positive things, like the Inflation Reduction Act, getting more electric vehicles on the road, far more solar and wind, finally looking at heat pumps. We can skip the gas stove debate today because it's ridiculous. But, you know, it's just hard to view him as a climate change leader when his administration would support something like this.
Things have been worse under the
disappointing.
But things have been worse under the Republicans, Judith.
Of course it would be worse. But the planet doesn't care. I mean, we're past the tipping point here.
A point I wanted to make, that's all.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? I mean, what is this? So the thing, you have hit so many elements on this just beautifully, but I one of the things that I got at the end of the article is, okay, so what does this mean for other projects that are, you know, not this project, but similar?
Right, right. Not a good sign, because if the federal agencies say no to similar projects, they'll have a case in court, you know, that the decision was arbitrary. There's also a massive petrochemical build-out happening where I just returned from in Louisiana and also Texas, which includes a lot of export of gas. And, you know, this is just not the direction the United States should be going toward. So, I think you put your finger on it, Joe. This is much bigger than the annoyingly named Willow Project. This may indeed open the door for other Alaska drilling drilling projects. And it's not lost on me that this news comes a few days after my old agency, the EPA, did a spectacularly wonderful thing of rejecting a copper and gold mining proposal in Bristol Bay, Alaska, which is one of the largest salmon fishery areas in the world. So it kind of feels like the Biden administration, you know, lets EPA follow the law, reject a potentially very damaging Bristol Bay project, and then a few days later, this analysis comes out. You know, I think part of this is trying to please Lisa Murkowski and the governor of Alaska, who they're totally on board with this ConocoPhillips project. I refuse to call it the Willow Project. It's too offensive to willows. But it's just, it's a high, you know, business as usual doesn't work on climate change. And the longer we wait to stop drilling for fossil fuel, the harder it's going to be to avoid catastrophic impacts.
Judith Henk on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 3rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org or via podcast. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.